Welcome to Fatal Flaw. I'm Molly.
And I'm Maddie.
A couple of disclaimers before we start. There will be spoilers for Percy Jackson and the Olympians and Heroes of Olympus. There will be adult language and adult topics, so proceed with caution. Mom, please don't listen to this. Melanie, your fucking microphone is so much better than mine. This is a very high-tech operation we got going here, Melanie.
This is surprisingly, Melanie, this is actually the best it's ever gone.
I love being privy to all this behind-the-scenes content.
God. Okay, so normally we type up episode notes. And it's like pretty detailed, at least the first couple were pretty detailed, and then they just kind of went off the rails.
But similar to this podcast.
Just like this episode. But I'm expecting that we will just start talking about one topic and then go on to other topics, and we'll just go off on tangents, and it's probably going to be really entertaining. But that means that I didn't want to be super structured, so I literally just wrote like the barest notes.
I can show you. I was like, I should take a couple notes before this starts, and I just wrote the names of some of the adults, and I have a heart drawn next to Sally and Paul Blofus's name, and then the other names are just there. That's it.
that's what our notes look like. Literally, it's the Google Drive.
I've got one note that says Quintus, Coach Hedge, yeah, plus his baseball bat, Mr. Chase plus his old plane.
That's Molly, you're missing so many adults.
I am missing so many adults. Well, the thing is, I was thinking about like adults in their capacity for caretaking children. Like being the caretakers.
Annabeth's dad needs to be
being the caretakers of children. And during the series, we like barely see Frederick Chase.
Okay, but he like swoops in and saves them in his old plane.
Okay, we'll talk about it. Let's just do.
Plus, we have to talk about him and Percy's interactions when Percy and Annabeth start dating, because I'm sure they are golden.
Oh my God, he's so awkward. Okay, so we're going to start the fucking episode.
I thought we already had. Is this not going to make it in?
I know. It's going to make it in.
Hello there, everyone. Welcome back to Fatal Flaw. Today, we have a very special guest with us today, Miss Melanie. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello. My name's Melanie. I'm so super duper excited to be here. I've been waiting to be on this podcast since I heard that it was happening. I also recently reread the Percy Jackson series. Molly texted me this summer and said, on a scale from 1 to 10, how into Percy Jackson are you? And I was holding one of the books in my hand at the time that she sent me that as I was doing my way through.
I don't think I knew that.
I was in the middle of rereading it and you were like, how into Percy Jackson are you? I was like, 10? It's like, it's in my hand right now.
That's like me carrying around a copy of Mark of Athena in my home office just because I like to have it near me. Like, at any given moment, I want to be able to be holding a Percy Jackson book.
It's like a security blanket.
It is. It's like a weighted blanket, but with more monsters.
Oh God.
It's like a weighted blanket, but with more representation.
I will say,
I think my weighted blanket has more representation than Rick Riordan's books.
There are more gay people in your weighted blanket. Who wore it better? Maddie's weighted blanket or Rick Riordan?
I do have a weighted blanket, and I think that the Percy Jackson books give me a little bit more emotional support. They're both essential.
But will the Percy Jackson books help you when you're touch-starved and gay?
Oh my God.
No. We're off to a good start here, folks. What are we talking about today? Today we're talking about adults and the caretakers in the Percy Jackson books, and basically how they fail at caretaking for these children. And I believe the title of the episode is going to be "Who Put You in Charge?" Who let you take care of children?
I actually think there's an answer for that for most of these people.
It's some idiot god who is like, yeah, they'd be good at taking care of kids.
Yeah, like Zeus, like not imprisoned, but like forced Dionysus to be at the camp, and I think Apollo put Chiron in charge of activities and training half-bloods, and whoever sculpted Terminus put him in charge of Camp Jupiter. So, you know, there's an answer to that question for almost every single adult.
Yeah, I think the point that I would really like to make here is that Camp Half-Blood, while the caretakers are Mr. D and Chiron, they're not super good at taking care of children. There is at least one adult assigned to take care of the children. At Camp Jupiter, the person in charge of the children is another child. It's just Reyna. I don't know how you pronounce Praetor. Is it Praetor or Praetor?
I always said Praetor.
I said like Praorder. Or
oh.
Something like that.
I don't speak Latin, so I don't pronounce
it. It's a
that.
Dead language, Maddie. Nobody does.
I'm pretty the sure classics your brother majors, does.
The classics majors here are gonna get so mad.
Honestly,
we're gonna get angry emails.
If there are classics majors listening to this, please stop. Do not listen to this. I don't want you involved in this podcast.
Hey, there are some people who are classics majors who I love.
Okay, fucking cut it. I don't care. Anyway, censored.
Maddie thinks I'm censoring her, but I cut more of my shit that I think is fucking hilarious. I think I'm the funniest person on this goddamn planet, and I cut my shit too, so it's just because I want to keep it under an hour. God. So the first caretaker that I
we need to backtrack like 10 steps. Because we haven't asked Melanie any of the important questions about her. We have not asked her to tell us a little bit about her. We have not asked her who her godly parent would be. And we have not asked her how we know her. You have just sidestepped every single thing that we would ever afford to a guest. This is the most disrespect I have ever seen. I'm so upset for Melanie right now. How could you do this to her? Oh my God.
Maddie, you're a true friend. You're the real OG.
Oh my God.
So Melanie, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Wait, we gotta rein it in.
Reyna? The primary caretaker of Jupiter?
Get out of here!
Go ahead, Maddie.
So we are very excited to have Melanie on our podcast today.
Oh,
so, Melanie, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hold on. Wait, but that's literally exactly what I just said. And you said I didn't do it correctly. And then you repeated exactly what I just said.
You didn't do it correctly. I was just, it sounded like we had come from a big train wreck, which we had. And I was like, I feel like we need to put this at the, like, we need to edit this to be at the beginning of the episode.
No, so I hope all like of this stays. I hope all of this stays in.
So, Melanie, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I, like many of Percy Jackson readers, am a theater major because I'm very basic. I'm in my senior year finishing up my acting degree, which is a great financial decision. Thank you, Maddie. Thank you, Molly. I started reading Percy Jackson, I think, when I was in middle school. And they were actually the first books that I ever read that like made me enjoy reading. I used to hate reading. Like I really did. Because I couldn't pay attention and I would start a book and then I would put it down. I liked the idea of books. I just didn't like actually reading them. And the last book had come out by the time that I'd started reading them because my brother had a signed copy, The Last Olympian, not like the full like second series, but I came to it later.
Your brother has a signed copy of The Last Olympian?
Yes, yes, he does. I'm very bitter that it's signed to him, especially since he doesn't even read the Percy Jackson books anymore. And I don't think he finished reading Heroes of Olympus.
For good reason. If he read The Lost Hero and then gave it up, that's fine. That's on
me. I'm texting him right now.
Oh my God.
Because I hate to say this, but he's coming on this podcast. And I know exactly which episode he's going to be on. So I'm going to get ready for this.
But so I came to it later because like I was just like bored and I needed something to like I wanted to read and we were supposed to read for school. And they were the first books that I was like, ooh, I like reading now. And then like I read all of them and became obsessed. So that's on that.
Yeah. So who would you say would be your godly parent?
All right. So I think
Maddie, we're like rolling up the sleeves. We're getting into it. All right.
A two-part answer.
Here we go.
Oh.
Okay.
Because probably my parent, and I've discussed this with fellow Percy Jackson readers, would probably be Apollo, but I would 100% join the hunt. With Artemis.
You like that twin thing then? That was a very poorly landed joke, so we're just gonna cut that one.
I think
that's the one thing that you say that I'm not gonna cut in this episode.
I think it's more of just like an I hate men thing. And after being to like two private women's colleges, Artemis just makes a lot of sense to me.
A lot of things make sense in retrospect once you realize you're some kind of queer. I don't want to like put labels on you, Melanie.
No, that's okay.
I think it's hilarious because when Melanie went off to college, she went to a small women's college and was like, yep, I'm straight. And then she went to another women's college. I think by then you had figured out some things about yourself. But you insisted. I remember you being like, just because I'm going to a women's college doesn't mean that it's like just full of lesbians. Like, that's such a harmful stereotype. And that's true. It is harmful to generalize about any group
of
people.
It is full of lesbians and bisexuals. Like, my primary friend group is exclusively bisexual. Yeah, I figured it out like my sophomore year of college. And I was like, oh, this checks out.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Guys, I am just hanging out with the wrong people, I feel like. Because my primary...
The wrong
my
people?
My primary friend group...
Are you homophobic?
No, I'm saying that my primary friend group is not a bunch of bisexuals. So I am hanging out with the wrong people. Because I need to hang out with more bisexuals.
Are you saying that me and Melanie are in your primary friend group?
I knew this was going to come up.
Maddie, it's okay for you to say that I'm not in your primary friend group because I'm not.
Yeah, I was like, Melanie, I'm not in your primary friend group as well. There's so many things that happens.
You're in my primary like Twitter friend group now. Like, you're one of the people who I like interact with a lot on Twitter.
Your messages are pinned. iPhone. Well, your conversation is pinned at the top of my messages.
Molly, app. What if
that's how primary
what if your pinned text messages touched my pinned text messages?
Do we want to talk about the fucking series or do we want to just keep going like this?
I've got to give our listeners something for the ship, okay?
I mean, I'm having fun either way.
But the problem is our names are so similar that our ship name would just be one.
That has literally been every guy I have had a thing with, by the way. Like, I didn't think it was a thing, and then it like in college it was a thing, and I was like, oh god, like I like have similar names to all of the guys that I've had romantic entanglements with, and I was like, oh god.
Do you want me to say how I met you guys?
Sure. Do you even remember?
Do you want to say
why? Do we even know how we...
I do remember how I met you, Molly.
Like, I know how I know you, but I don't remember meeting you for the first time.
Like, I mean, we just knew each other. I think, like, we met at field hockey. Or it might have been a birthday party before then, but, like, we really didn't meet each other until we started playing field hockey.
Melody, we knew each other for years before that. Melody, we weren't close. Like,
I think I knew who you were, but like we didn't know each other. Like, I think I saw you at like one of like Lindsay's birthday parties or at, like a Girl Scout thing, but like we didn't know each other.
Like, your best friend was my best friend. Your best friend,
but
was
we
my
never
best
interacted,
friend.
Molly.
Like, we knew each other. We were at birthday parties. Melody.
I'm just being real. We did not speak to each other until we started playing field hockey together.
Yes, sir.
Melanie is telling you.
I remember you for years.
Melanie is telling you that you were not in her primary friend group for a very long time.
Oh my god! But I'll give you that. That I don't. I have a shit memory, so I just assumed that we like had interacted previously, but okay, go ahead.
Molly, I think it was like halfway through my freshman year before I even realized that you had a twin. Like, we did not know each other.
I had incorrectly assumed that we had interacted before field hockey, but go ahead, Melanie.
So we met during like field hockey and that's when we became friends. Molly, okay. And I both played defense.
Gay.
It's because we didn't like running.
That is a fact. And we still got to hit people with sticks. It was the perfect combination.
According to the rules, we are not supposed to hit people with the sticks.
Okay.
Okay, Terminus. Let's...
Maddie, I don't remember when we met.
Actually, we haven't met. Hi, my name's Maddie.
Hi, super great to meet you. Maddie just came to my house a lot because you would hang out with my brother. And, like, you would come over for game nights, which I was never invited to.
You weren't invited?
No.
I always assumed you didn't want to hang out with us.
No, Milo never invited me. Milo was like, I'm having my friends over and we're having game night. And I was like, okay, I guess I'll, like, hang out in my room.
I swear to God, if we don't talk about these fucking books anytime soon, I'm closing my computer. I'm removing my headphones.
Which adult would you like to talk about first, Molly? Do you want to talk about Sally? Do you want to talk about Chiron?
I don't want to talk about any of them except for Sally and Paul because, like, they all just suck at being caretakers for these children. But let's start off with Chiron. There's nothing – literally, our notes for this are just their names because I figure as soon as I say the name, like, there's going to be some kind of tangent that we go off on. So go ahead.
Something really interesting is that Chiron is the first adult that we meet in – the books.
I think there's something to be said about the fact that, like, even as Mr. Brunner, like, he's introduced to us as like kind of a nice guy, but then by the end of the day, like when they leave the museum, he's a little bit rude to Percy, and Percy's like, oh, Mr. Brunner hurt my feelings and like called me stupid.
Oh, you think? Yeah, I was just like,
he gaslights him,
being mean to children. Crazy. The casual gaslighting of Percy by Grover and Chiron in the next couple of months when he's at school is just fascinating to me.
Criminal.
And Grover's like, oh, I think we should tell him. And Chiron's like, no, we must gaslight him for longer because we have reasons. And Grover's like, oh, I don't know why.
And then Chiron's like, let's continue to lie to this poor child for, like, years to come about, like, knowledge of his future and, like, who he's going to be.
I want to point out that throughout his whole life so far, Percy has so few adult role models that Mr. Brunner being like, yeah, Percy, you're pretty good at this, is, like, life-changing for him. Mr. Brunner doesn't actually do, like, an outstanding, like going the extra mile kind of teacher thing. All he does is, like, not be abusive and shitty to him like the other teachers do. Like, it even says at one point in the canon, like, the other teachers would call me stupid. Like, it's oh so my sad. God. It's so sad. He's a child. And all Mr. Brunner had to do was not actively insult him. And then he was like, this is the best teacher I've ever had.
Rick, being a teacher, because he's a middle school teacher, or was, I don't know if he still is. Update your resume, Rick. But I think he was probably trying to make a lot of like social commentary about our education system with Mr. Brunner. Like, Mr. Brunner was not a good teacher. I mean, mm-hmm. he wasn't a bad teacher, but he wasn't a good teacher. He wasn't exceptionally nice. But that was literally all Percy needed, because our school system is so abusive to poor and disabled children that someone like Percy is literally just going to get lost in the system. And if he was Black, he probably would have already been arrested for doing something dumb. The only reason Percy wasn't in jail is because he was white. Very sad fact, but like very true.
Yeah.
Like later in the book, when he like accidentally like burns down a gym, which isn't really his fault, but he gets blamed for it. He would have been sent to jail, like in any realistic setting, for burning down a school gymnasium. I think that'd be considered like domestic terrorism.
And I know this isn't the topic of this podcast episode, but the fact that the country goes on a nationwide manhunt for this 12-year-old and it didn't end in him being shot by the police in California is very telling, because he is a white boy. If he was Black, he would have been dead by the end of the first book. Not because a literal god killed him, but because the American police force did. But that's neither here nor there. We will get into that in another episode, I'm sure.
Which also shows that the caretakers are not good at being caretakers in this book.
I think he like tries to make that point that's like, even if you don't have like good adult influences, because a lot of children in this country don't, like you can still be successful and you can still find yourself and have successful relationships outside of the relationships of authority figures in your life.
Yes. Maddie's just preaching today. I feel like I'm at the church service.
So I don't know. I don't feel like we have to say so like a lot about Chiron, because like we know he is let's say something positive about Chiron. Let's try to hit something positive and negative, because most of them are going to be negative, but let's try to keep it balanced. What's something good that you can say about,
I mean, like, I think he does like care for all of the campers, like on a like a deep personal level, like, and he cares like for their safety, even though like we don't always see that. And he's at least like nice to them and like calls them by their real names. But then he also does things like plucks them up and sticks them on his horseback without their permission. So there's that.
But he knows their names while he does it.
Exactly.
The bar is on the literal fucking ground. Oh my God.
But you know what? Some of these characters are about to limbo. The bar is so low.
They got out a shovel. They went into the labyrinth. Digging. It was on the ground.
They're like, let me just sneak into the labyrinth to not meet anyone's expectations.
It's very confusing, because like they say over and over, like, we didn't think we would live past 16. Like, that's something that's like, mm-hmm. we didn't make that up. Like, it's in the text. Like, most demigods don't live past a certain age. But then they also turn around and talk about like, oh yeah, such and such was a demigod. Like, oh yeah, Amelia Earhart, she was a demigod. And they like list all these historical figures, like they do little cameos and say like, oh yeah, these famous people are demigods. But so what's the truth? What is it? Because I was going to say,
well,
that if like, it does sound like they for the most part do make it out alive, or else every single child would have way more.
I would say that most of them don't make it out. But the select few that do have very niche careers, and that's like how they made it out. Cause like, I feel like run of the mill, like half-bloods are going to get like fucking slaughtered by monsters before they even make it to Camp Half-Blood. But then the few that do, and then don't go on quests. Yeah. Cause like, there are a lot of half-bloods that just never go on quests. Like Annabeth went for however many years without going on a quest, even though she wanted to. But what about the ones that don't want to? And they're just like, oh, I'm just going to go do rock climbing and make a wicker basket. You know, like, they made it to adulthood.
Well, and I think we also need to bring up the fact that it's actually most Greek demigods don't make it to adulthood, but then they get to New Rome and they're like, half the city is populated by adults with families. So what is going on at Camp Half-Blood that they managed to slaughter all of these children, but the Romans have it figured out so they can live?
Yes! Oh my god! Jeez! Okay, so I was texting Megan the other day about Percy Jackson, as we so often do, and she was like, wait, so when Percy and Annabeth have kids and they get to Camp Half-Blood, like, what cabin are they going to stay in? And it made me realize that so few demigods make it to the age where they can have children, that the cabin system has never had to accommodate people who have more than one godly ancestor.
They don't have...
Would they still, like, have, like, any, like, real, like, powers or, like, the scent? Are they still technically a demigod if they're...
I think that's a good point that actually is talked about a lot in Blood of Olympus, because Octavian isn't actually, like, a direct line from Apollo. Like, he's not Apollo's son. He's Apollo's, like, great-great-grandson or whatever. And so I think... that I don't know where I was going with that, but that was like so interesting because it's something that they guess have worked out in like the Roman side, but then Rick, get on here, explain this to us, because I'm very confused about how you came up with this system. This doesn't make any sense to me.
It's so confusing because like we know that Frank in the later books has multiple different sources of his godliness, and we know that the shape-shifting power has been passed through generation to generation, so clearly, like, even though he is not a direct, I mean,
that doesn't make any sense to me.
He's the son of Mars, but then he also has like the other like magical powers that have been passed down to him.
See, he has some Roman and some Greek and some Chinese lineage. But he also is the direct son of Mars, which is very confusing. So I don't really know what his powers can be chalked up to, except the shape-shifting comes directly from his family, not Mars. So I'm so confused. But it's interesting because they only have 13 cabins at Camp Half-Blood, which means that they've never had to deal with people with multiple
maybe lineages. When they're adults, they like don't go back to Camp Half-Blood. They just like
right,
but how many of them necessarily have kids with other half-bloods?
Oh, those kids are fucking. And by that I mean people who were kids who met at camp and then grew up to get
married. Because there are rules. No boys in girls' rooms.
Yeah, or vice versa. The demigods, absolutely. I mean, who else? Can you imagine a demigod marrying a mortal?
I mean, the gods have kids. So, like, why wouldn't the demigods?
Yeah, but can you imagine being like, hey, every so often a monster might attack
me. But they say, like, when they're adults, like, their scent goes down. Like, they're just, like, really smelly as, like, teenagers because they're going through puberty. But when they hit, like, adulthood, most of them, like, end up having longer lives because they don't.
Yes!
They're like, once
do they
you make
that?
It to adulthood, like, you're kind of, like, in the clear because your scent goes down.
Show us in the text! Show us in the text!
I'm sorry, I told you the notes that I took. Do you think I pulled direct quotes from the books for this? They talk about that, I swear to God.
Do they? I mean, well, they do say that, like, it's based on how powerful you are, so I guess it's just being ageist and saying that, like, power diminishes as your body as your body atrophies.
Because like Percy asks, like, where are all of the adults, like, when he gets to Camp Half-Blood, and they're like, well, one, either they don't make it to adulthood, or the ones who do no longer have to worry about being attacked by monsters.
Yeah, do we have time for me to just go grab my book?
Now that we're talking about Camp Half-Blood versus New Rome, can we talk about the main caretaker in New Rome, which is a fucking statue? I was trying to figure out, like, who would you consider to be, like, the main adult in charge? Like, who's the HBIC at Camp Jupiter, and the only adult there is fucking Terminus.
Literal statue. It was like, leave the weapon and outside.
All he does is yell at the children. He doesn't care for them. He's not, like, responsible for them. He just makes sure they follow the rules. He's like a fucking, like, he's more like a subway turnstile than a caretaker.
Which is interesting because New Rome has adults. Like, they have people who could be in charge and could be caring for the children.
Yes! There's a literal city full of adults who not only can be caretakers for children, but also definitely have military experience, because they call like service to Camp Jupiter like military service or whatever. It's super militaristic and problematic, but they like put in their time, they serve their years in the military side, which is run by children, and then they can go live in the peaceful city of New Rome. So there's absolutely some kind of adult there who has the understanding of Camp Jupiter's workings and is yet also a fucking adult. And yet, here's Reyna, a fucking 17-year-old with a whole world on her shoulders. Are you kidding me?
She does.
Reyna deserves
better. I'm not
going
to dispute that.
There's apparently supposed to be two Praetors at any given time, even though anytime we see Reyna, she's like the only person in charge there, because Jason and Percy and who else is the other? And Frank like are not there most of the time. So are they doing age by like combining them? Because technically, if there's two 17-year-olds, that makes a 34-year-old, right? So technically, there's one adult in charge. They just split
it's a
it
horrible
up
system, really.
That's messed up. That's just
it's at some point someone said, you know who should be in charge of this army of children? Children.
I mean, is that supposed to be some kind of commentary? Was that done on purpose? That was this some kind of like Hunger Games-esque, like we're putting children in this dangerous situations and not taking care of them? Or was it just
I
like,
don't know if it's like a well, you're gonna have to go on quests on your own, so you might as well like grow up and train on your own also, like preparing them. But even just the fact that these adults who are supposed to be caretakers are like, yeah, let's send the 12-year-olds with no experience on a dangerous quest, that'll work out well.
I mean, by was it the Titan's Curse or Battle of the Labyrinth, we meet this like council
oh,
of the
I
senior
love the council
the council of the senior counselors. Oh, the most senior counselors, like the most authoritative people at Camp Half-Blood, and they're 16.
They do. That's like the student council, though. That's like, in my opinion, that's more like, what? Don't look at me like that. It's like, you know, you have these people, they're elected into a position of power, they sit around, they drink juice boxes, they pretend to really get things done, but really Kyren's there and he's like, well guys, this is actually what we're gonna do. So that's like the social studies teacher who volunteered to do the after school activity where the children try to say that they're running the school. It's the same thing. Because really, the Stoll brothers and Will Solis are not making any decisions at camp. Like, let's be real. Will Solis can deliver a baby, but he can't, like, decide when bedtime is. That's not how this works.
Oh, God.
I will say, bedtime
so
just reminded me about the harpies at Camp Half-Blood, where if you're not in bed at night, the harpies will eat you.
They literally fucking attack you.
Or like, if you like leave your cabin in the middle of the night, like the harpies will literally kill you. Someone thought that was a good
I just
system.
Have to say,
oh my God.
I just have to say, Ella would never.
We stan Ella.
Oh God.
We've talked about two adults.
We need to get through this. Okay, let's talk about Sally and Paul. Because we need, like, an uptick in the energy here. We need some love.
Sally is the best character. I would die for Sally. She's incredible. Her killing Gabe is some hot girl shit. Period. End of story.
So, Melanie, how old do you think Sally is? Okay.
I picture her like, young mom.
There is no canon answer. I researched it extensively. because I was like, I want to know how old she is, but there is no answer to how old she is.
I think she's like young mom. So I think like maybe early 30s. That's what I feel. Like, and I feel like her being a young mom kind of like,
yeah,
gives her like that like stronger connection with Percy, if that makes sense.
It reminds me a lot of Gilmore Girls, how Lorelai was very, very young when she had Rory. Mm-hmm. And so they grew up kind of a little bit more like sisters. Like, she did not play a motherly role. Like, she did not discipline Rory. She did not, you know what I mean? Like, she didn't play that role of like the mother figure. It was very much like, we're BFFs, because they were so close in age. So I think in some ways that I could totally see Sally being a little bit like that, where she was so young when she had him that they get really, really close. And she does absolutely play that mother figure role, but I could see it being something like where they're very emotionally close. But okay, you know how I said we were going to do like one positive thing and one negative thing about people? Percy does have some issues because he wasn't with his mom for a lot of his childhood. She did send him believe me, I 100% know, like, I 100% know that there was a very good reason she was with Gabe. There was a very good reason she sent him off to school, like boarding school. But also, you just got to think that in some ways it would have been better if they had been together.
I can see that. But I also think, I wonder if like some of it, like not only for like Percy's safety, some of it might have been for her safety as well. You know? I mean, like, if obviously like she knows that like Percy is a demigod, and like she knows that like he's going to be attacked by monsters, and she's sending him to the boarding schools so he can be like surrounded by all these other scents, and also because he's been kicked out of every public school. But I mean, without like, if Gabe like wasn't around and like Percy's scent was that strong, Percy would be attacked, but so would Sally. And if Sally's dead, who's gonna take care of Percy? Nobody.
Ain't nobody taking care of him anyway.
I love Sally, but while we're talking about it, I do think that she could have done better in being there emotionally for Percy and being there physically, being with him. We only meet him in like sixth grade, but I don't know. I'm going to get a lot of hate for this. I just think that there are some things that Sally could have done better. And I don't mean to like put all the responsibility on a single mother, especially a very young single mother, but it just makes me so sad to think about how Percy was at boarding school alone, and that was his main home.
I think that,
I don't know,
there's a lot of the relationship between Percy and Sally that we don't see. I think Rick did that a disservice, because mm-hmm. I think if he had explored the relationship between Percy and his mom more, I think it would have been really great. But I also think there is that other like aspect of it where sometimes the adults in our lives have to make choices that are not necessarily the best for everyone involved. And as kids, we don't understand it. But then later, as we grow up, we understand it even more. Like that, like with Gabe, honestly, I think Gabe was probably the dumbest plot device in that freaking book. Like, what? His scent covered up the scent of the step. That doesn't make any sense. That is a poor excuse for an abusive asshole being in her life. Honestly, I hated it. But it's one of those choices that adults make that children don't understand. And we resent our parents for making that decision until we get older and we realize, oh, this was actually what was for the best. This is what had to be done. So there's a lot of room for improvement in Sally's parenting. She was a young mom. She was a single mother. She literally didn't have any family around to help her raise this literal demon child who blew up schools. So yeah, maybe there was a lot of things that she wishes she could have done differently or had to do and she didn't want to do, but You know, Sally's just doing her best, man.
And
She's
you know what?
Awesome. She's a
she
great
obviously
person.
Did something right because Percy, one, respects women, and two, loves his mother so deeply and talks about her all the time.
Yes. Oh. Yes. Totally agree. I don't want it to seem like I'm like hating on Sally or anything. I just think she was in a very complicated position, and I want Percy to have had a stable, structured home. A stable, safe home to have grown up in, and I guess I'm taking it out on Sally that he didn't have that.
But I guess
it's
you
not
could say
fault.
Technically that Annabeth had a stable, safe home that she could have grown up in, but being a demigod ruined that.
I think having a shitty stepmother ruined that. Let's talk about Frederick and Mrs. Chase. Good transition, Maddie. What the fuck? She's a child. Oh my god. Okay, go ahead.
I think it's really interesting that the way that the like story around them is framed is that like Annabeth has all these like horrible stories about the stepmother and about her dad. But then when we meet them like through Percy's view, and Percy's like, oh, they're not so bad. And I think it's interesting that that's how we get that introduction, like true introduction to them is like not through Annabeth's eyes anymore, really. And he's like, oh, Annabeth, like, why are you complaining? It's not so bad. I'm like, well, yeah, they're being nice to you.
I'm going to go ahead and be the enemy on this podcast. And I'm going to get so much hate for this. I'm going to just defend Mrs. Chase. I'm going to do it. So, yeah. So we talk about...
Okay, go ahead. See what happens.
Oh, I'm going to get like a nasty letter in the mail. yes.
From me?
You know where I live. Anyway. So let's think about this for a second. Mrs. Chase comes in. I also cut this out, but I've been watching a lot of Life with Derek.
You think I'm gonna cut that shit?
It has literally, I don't know what it is. It has become a weird comfort show that I have been watching at like 2 o'clock in the morning.
The sexual tension in that show is not appropriate for children.
Okay, I'm going to defend Mrs. Chase. So she marries Frederick. They have two kids together. I know Annabeth says that she doesn't accept her into her family. We don't see much of the relationship between Mrs. Chase and Annabeth until Mark of Athena, when we have the discussion about the spiders. Annabeth is obviously probably not the easiest child to take care of. I know I'm going to get so much hate for this, but children with like ADHD and all that stuff, they're not easy to take care of. That is a fact. I'm not saying it's right to like treat them as lesser, all that stuff, but Annabeth, she's not going to be an easy child. She's a demigod, which is like literally another realm of difficulty. And, you know, Mrs. Chase is a mother to two young boys as well. She's got her hands full. Annabeth calls her in the middle of the night and is like, oh, there's spiders all over the place. There are literally no spiders there. Like, what are you going to do? Like, do you say like, oh, like, let me get all these spiders out of here, but there's literally no spiders. Like, I honestly don't understand like how Mrs. Chase was in the wrong there, because there was literally no evidence of it. And I know that's super unfortunate, and it has to do with like it being a supernatural thing. Like, Mrs. Chase is not anywhere near the gods or any like whatever Greek stuff. But like, when you've got a child that like is very difficult and is waking you up in the middle of the night saying that there's things in there that are like literally there's nothing in there, what are you gonna do?
Care for that child is what you're going to do. The child is scared and needs you to care for them, needs you to show like affection and be protective and say, I hear you. I don't see it, but I know that it's, even if it's not there, it's scaring you. Even if this is a bad dream, even if Mrs. Chase does think she's making it up, like, she still needs to, like, get down to the bottom of it. Why is this child screaming and scared and crying in the middle of the night? Like, you still do need to take care of that child, even if it's not real.
And I agree with that. I agree 100% with that. And I'm not saying that Mrs. Chase is, like, a perfect person that, like, did no wrong. Like, obviously, she was not a good stepmom to Annabeth. However, it is very stressful raising two young children and having a child with ADHD screaming in the middle of the night. We don't have any other interactions with them ever. Ever. We don't know if this is the first time that this has happened, if this is the 30th time this has happened. Obviously, they need to go to a therapist. That's another conversation, though. I'm just saying, I'm not going to make Mrs. Chase to be the villain from that one scene alone, because we don't know any other interactions that they've had.
Except for the fact that Annabeth ran away at 7 years old. I mean, it has to have been bad. We have to believe that all the things Annabeth said about how she never made me feel like I was part of the family. She made it feel like the twin brothers were her real kids and Annabeth was just putting them in danger. I feel like as an adult, you have to hide so much from the kids. Parents are scared all the fucking time. Every time a kid gets their driver's license, Olivia Rodrigo, every time a kid goes off to spend the night at someone else's house, like, parents are driven crazy by fear. But you know what they do? They get scared behind closed doors. They talk to other adults about how scared they are. They don't put that on the kids. And oh my God, it's a fucking demigod and there are monsters chasing my children. Yeah, I'm scared out of my fucking mind. If I were her, I would be terrified. But you talk to someone else about that. You experience those fears behind closed doors and in front of the kid, all you present to them is confidence and safety and love. Like, I understand the feelings, but you just gotta fucking fake it sometimes, you know? Like, when parents see their kids go off to kindergarten, I can tell you almost every parent will probably have put on a brave face and said, yay, isn't this so exciting? I'm so happy for you to go to kindergarten. And then as soon as they got on the bus, they were, like, bawling. Because you put on a brave face, and the things that you show the kids are different from the things that you're actually feeling. So I completely, you are so, so right, Maddie. She is totally reasonable in having those feelings, but you don't put it on the child. You deal with it.
I do, though. I think Maddie brought up an interesting point, and that is that all of these characters desperately need therapy.
We have said that on every single episode of this podcast.
Yeah.
Because it's fucking true.
The amount of trauma that every single character goes through and they just, like, deal with it and, like, internalize it. Luke would have benefited so much from some therapy.
Like, oh my God. We can't even get into Luke.
It would have been a different book.
Oh my God.
This is an anti-Luke podcast, so you don't need to mention his name.
But also, if Mae Castellan had gotten the mental health resources that she deserved, Luke would not have been in that situation in the first place. He would have had a caretaker who had the resources that she needed. But Mae fell through the cracks of our fucking healthcare system, and we ended up with someone with daddy issues.
I can't wait for our healthcare episode. I am so ready to bring the knowledge. Anyway,
I'd love for you to talk about how different these books would have been if some of these kids were on Adderall.
Okay, let's talk about Coach Hedge.
We need to get through these other ones.
Do we want to talk about Mr. D?
Mr. D sucks. He should not be in charge of children, but he's like a comedic relief.
He does have his moments. There's only like two of them between both book series, but he does have... like a couple moments. One of them is like,
he really does.
There's like one where it's his like Roman version of himself, and like when he does decide to help out, he is like decently helpful. It's just a very rare occurrence.
So that's Mr. D. We've talked about Terminus, we've talked about Sally and Paul, we didn't really talk about Paul. Anything
I love Paul. Paul is so sweet. Paul, like, gets Percy, like, into the private school and, like, is, like, willing to help him and, like, treats him like a son. Like, after he and Sally get together. I like Paul.
Maddie, I would consider you an expert on stepfamilies because you do you do watch Life with Derek religiously.
But yeah, I am the expert on blended families.
Because you watch Life with Derek.
Because I watch Life with Derek.
I think Paul is such a good role model for Percy. It's interesting that in the books where he's most figuring out who he's going to be as a person, which is, I would say, Titan's Curse and Battle of the Labyrinth are where he really starts considering, like, what kind of man am I going to be? What kind of adult do I want to grow into? What are my values? Are a huge running theme through that. Also happens to be when Paul comes into the picture.
Oh, Paul.
And I think that's such good timing because that's a time that he really needs a role model there.
Also, I really appreciate that, like, Paul learns about, like, all of the gods and, like, learns that, like, Percy is a demigod and he just rolls with it.
Also, I know, I'm sorry this is not the topic, but bye bye. Right? He's like, oh, I did Shakespeare in college. We all know what doing Shakespeare in college is code for, Paul. And on the last caretaker that we have to talk about is Coach Hedge.
Coach Hedge is such a character. Like, I love him, but sometimes I'm just like, why is he here?
Honestly, I think Coach Hedge could have been a way better character than he was made to be. So, like, in my head, he's not as, like, violent because I don't like it. But I absolutely love that they could have literally taken any satyr on this freaking trip with them to Europe. Like, Grover is, like, right fucking there. And they choose the weirdest, like, shortest little man goat that they could possibly find. And it just makes my heart happy. And we talked about this on another podcast that after he leaves, they, like, Leo still, like, makes a little, his table, like, say things that Coach Hedge does. And I think it's to cock block his friends because he's bitter. But I also think it's because they, as much as they act like they don't love Coach Hedge, they actually really
do. I think Coach Hedge does a better job of trying to protect the children than almost any other adult in the books. Yes, he's doing it just with a baseball bat, and it's not always effective, but he tries. And I think there's something to be said for that.
Also, I really relate. Do you know how many times when I am talking to a dear friend, I will say, do you want me to fucking fight him for you? Like, when any minor inconvenience for someone I love, I'm like, all right, I will fight with my fists. And so I relate. So, Melanie, I am so fucking proud of this game that we're about to do. I am so excited for us to do this. And I have kept it a secret from you. I have not told you what it is. So now that we're done with the main portion, you know, every week we do a fun little game or little activity or something. This week, I have created a Percy Jackson English essay prompt generator, where the first part is something from the Percy Jackson universe, and the second part is, like, an English paper theme. And the question is, what is the significance of blank as it relates to blank? So you're going to say the fourth letter of your first name and the day that you were born, like, numerically. And we're going to give you a prompt. And on the spot, you have to show off your bullshitting skills and give us a quick, like, English essay answering that prompt.
I can't believe you've just given me homework.
Now, all of us are excellent bullshitters. But Melanie, you should be especially good at this because you are on the improv team.
And I also was an English major for a short amount of time, and I made my way through by BSing absolutely everything.
Then this should be good. Are you ready to dive in?
Perfect.
Okay. So what is the significance of blank as it relates to blank? Melanie, what's the fourth letter of your first name? A. What is the significance of capture the flag as? What's 14. What day were you born? What's your birth date? 14. Oh, well, that's lame.
Wait,
that's
what is
it? What is the significance of capture the flag as it relates to teamwork?
I'm so glad you asked. So obviously capture the flag is a team building game. If you don't work as a team, nobody's going to win. Percy tries to like go off on his own and like doesn't try to do like what Annabeth tells him to do, and everything goes to shit and they lose capture the flag because he couldn't participate as a teammate. It's all about building camaraderie and togetherness as a team. That is the whole reason that they play. It's to get them working as a team, strategizing as a team, fighting as a team, so they can go out and die as a team on quests. Thank you.
There we have it, folks. I feel like that was such a cop-out. You need to not have been born on the 14th.
What's yeah, that's kind of bullshit.
What day was your mom born?
27th.
Melanie, what is the significance of capture the flag as it relates to race relations? She's thinking, folks.
No, I'm not.
Head empty, no thoughts.
As it race relations.
I have an idea.
I would love for you to take a crack at it.
Thank you. Now the point of this is to bullshit. So it doesn't have to actually make sense in the text, but so the significance that I've found in this is that the leaders of Capture the Flag are determined by who won the last game. So the leaders are usually the Athena cabin and the Ares cabin because they tend to be the winners. And I think that relates to race in America because the people who got ahead in the past still have this privilege and they have a step up for the next round, the next year, the next generation. And that's my Percy Jackson English essay about race relations and capture the flag.
I feel like that's a decent answer. I was trying to Very think good. Of like,
Thank
I
you.
Think I misunderstood because I was trying to think of like race relations within Percy Jackson. And I was like, they're mostly
oh,
white.
No. I mean,
Melanie was like trying to relate it to a race war. She's like, cap two teams fighting each other.
Maddie, do you want to do yours?
Oh, sure.
Are you going by Maddie or Madeline? Because that changes things.
I'll do Maddie because that's what I go by on the podcast.
Okay. I would like to point out, I don't think Maddie goes by Maddie in most other areas of her life. I think
Yeah, I do.
You do?
The only place I don't go by Maddie is at work. Except everybody at work, for some reason in the past 2 weeks, has started calling me Maddie. And I was like, I have literally never told you people you could call me Maddie. What the fuck is happening?
To the podcast.
No!
They found at Fatal Flaw PJO on Twitter and Instagram.
Maybe it's just a comfort thing. They feel comfortable around you, so they feel like they can call you Maddie.
Well, they shouldn't. They shouldn't feel comfortable around me.
Okay, Maddie, what's your Percy Jackson English essay prompt generator?
Okay, what is the significance of pinochle as it relates to modern technology?
Hold on.
The game that Mr. D
That's how
and,
you pronounce it, right?
Yeah. It's the game that Mr. D and Chiron play on the front porch of the
Yeah,
house.
That's right. Thank you.
So I guess what I will say, I actually don't know how to play pinochle at all, but I'm going to assume that since it's a card game, they are always trying to put different things together, cards together, suits, numbers, etc. And, you know, that's just how we work with technology. Technology is always changing. The game is always changing. We are constantly playing off of each other's moves. Mr. D makes a move. Chiron makes a move. Samsung makes a move. Apple then copies that move. That's just kind of how we go in our society. Late stage capitalism. There is no independent thought. All the kids are forced to play Pinochle when they get there. No independent thought. That's all I got.
Yes, Maddie, that was amazing.
I have no idea how to play Pinochle. All right, Molly.
Okay. I feel like this is cheating because I made it. But okay. The fourth letter of my first name is L, and that is Iris Messaging. And I was born on the 26th. So that is lust for power. What is the significance of Iris Messaging as it relates to lust for power? Well, the first thing that comes to mind is that when we actually meet the goddess Iris, she has like this co-op in the middle of nowhere. It's like a store co-op, very hippie stuff. And I feel like that's a subversion of the lust for power trope, where she is a very powerful being. Clearly, she must be a powerful being because she has these beautiful, wonderful powers of connecting people to each other. You can, with just a golden drachma and some light refraction,
gay energy.
some light refraction and gay energy, you can contact anyone anywhere. It's a very powerful thing. And also she has that power to possibly listen in on people, to cut people off. At a certain point, Iris Messaging stops working. So she is, like, she's a minor goddess, but she also has a lot of power. And instead of wielding that power for evil, she turns it into something for the community. She makes it a co-op where she lifts up other people's work, and gives other people a platform to share their goods and services. And I think that's a subversion of the lust for power that we so often see in the gods. How about that?
Right. Beautiful.
Thank you. Can we do Percy?
Yeah.
Okay. P-E-R-C.
I didn't realize.
What?
Melanie.
I was like, I think we'd all like to do Percy. I did not know what you meant.
Okay, wait, no, there's one that I really want to do, so we're just, who's a character whose fourth letter of their name is M? Permsy.
Terminus!
Terminus! Thank you! Terminus. Thank you, Matt. I'm actually so impressed that you came up with that.
And I got excited, too.
And Percy's birthday is the 18th, so, So what is the significance of Rachel Elizabeth Dare's blue hairbrush as it relates to, now this theme was directly ripped from like a Great Gatsby essay. What is the significance of Rachel Elizabeth Dare's blue hairbrush as it relates to moving on from the past?
Very good.
Anybody got anything?
We're just talking about it.
Saying
no, I want right, your bullshit
so
essay.
Rachel Elizabeth Dare and her hairbrush is like symbolism of her like growing up and stepping into this new world and like leaving the past. Like she brings this hairbrush with her, like she throws it, and I can't remember what she hits with it. She hits Kronos,
she hits
in the eye,
Kronos in the eye, and then he hit his face like falters, and we see Luke for
right.
a second. So it's not Kronos. Yeah, it's not Kronos for a second. Luke has come through, so it's clear that like Luke is still alive inside there.
I think like, and then it snaps her, back like, into throwing Kronos. This hairbrush and like having this moment like with Kronos is like her like really stepping into like the Greek god universe and like leaving everything that she knew about the world and like her past behind. Like this is like a major turning point. There's no going back after you hit Kronos in the eye with the hairbrush.
Can I do one? Can I do one bouncing off of that?
Yeah.
So I think the fact that she threw the blue hairbrush at Kronos, hit him in the eye, and then we saw Luke, shows us that we have to, even while we're moving on from the past, we always need to remember our roots, aka little blonde boy. and so we always need to remember our past, and we can't truly move on from our past until we accept it, and we accept what we have done, we accept how we will move forward from it, which is exactly what Luke does at the end of The Last Olympian. All right, Melanie, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a wild ride, I think, from start to finish.
It's literally going to take like a week to edit this.
I was thinking that. Melanie, would you like to plug your pluggables and tell people where to find you? You don't have to if you don't want people to find you on social media.
You can follow me on my Instagram, which is not private, which is MissMelBell98, MissMelBell98. You can also find me on MelanieMoody.com, which is my personal website.
Thank you. Hey, look at you.
I like it.
I feel like a proud mother right now.
I do. It's my professional website, but I'll probably link this like podcast episode on the website just because I can.
Yes! Prove that you have a really good
mic. And I can add my additional like adult hot takes when we post this. We didn't talk about half the adults. Like, we didn't talk about Tantalus at all.
We
in Sea of Monsters.
Oh my god. There's so much to be said about the fact that being a caretaker for these children is punishment by Zeus for people he disagrees with.
Hey, I have been a camp counselor before. It fucking sucks, man. Taking care of 7-12-year-olds was torture.
If it were just a summer camp, that would be one thing. They're year-round campers. These are their primary caretakers.
It's awful. It's
so bad.
I have a friend that's a middle school teacher. She tells me it is terrible. You could not pay me enough to do that.
I think when we really think about it, Mr. D's kind of a sympathetic character.
I agree.
I would be in that position too. That's how I would act too. Also, it's fucking hilarious.
Peter Johnson.
Call Percy by his first name.
I think it's
Perry Johansson, Annabelle, Colin. Oh my god, it's fucking hilarious. He does it on purpose. He doesn't forget. He knows Percy's name.
He's literally not allowed to drink a drop of alcohol while dealing with these children.
Well, that's probably for the best.
He's like God of Wine and the partying, and they're like, no wine for you.
Hang out at this PG.
All you get is Diet
camp.
Coke and a prayer.
Oh God. Thank you so much for being on this, Melanie.
That
was so fun.
We
have to have
you
back
sometime. With you guys.
That was awesome.
Thank you for listening to Fatal Flaw. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at FatalFlawPJO. Music by David Thal from the band Glass Bandit. You can find them on social media at Glass Bandit Music. You've been listening to Fatal Flaw.
Thank you for having
me. Please never speak to us again.